planning is valuable, but also things that you cannot really plan suddenly appear. And then it's highly crucial that you recognize this window of opportunity and just jump in.
Welcome to the Growth Show. What keeps us driving is what drives you further. This is your hosts, Sebastian Kunz
and Sarah Kaya.
So we are today with Michael Assauer, who is founder of Familonet, which is a Hamburg-based startup acquired by Moovil, a Daimler subsidiary. Familonet is still active and is actually a geo-based startup with which you can just track your whole family, and it's just some sort of a social network for the family. Mm-hmm. And we actually, Michael and his co-founder has achieved amazing stuff, and this is why we're here today. We'll talk with him about interesting topics, all about growth hacking, and also some interesting stories about Familonet, and maybe also a little bit about Moovil. All right, so thank you for inviting us, Michael.
Yeah, thank you, and welcome to the show.
Gracias.
So, who are you and what do you do for a living today?
Yeah, well, as you said, I'm Michael. I'm one of the three founders of Familonet. Familonet was our first product, B2C product, within our Familonet company. It's a location-based social network for families, small groups, flatmates, etc., and it allows you to share your location with others. And over the time, we evolved to be more of a real tech company in terms of mobile location technologies. We also started a B2B business within the Familonet company, in which we distributed our mobile location technology as an SDK and an API to other product developers, and we also started kind of an agency business in which we built entire products for other players. And these were basically the three bases of our company. And this entire thing got acquired by Daimler 1 year ago. We're now with Moovil, which is the mobility or the multimodal mobility platform subsidiary of Daimler. And yeah, now we're part of the Daimler family. And in my daily work, I would say I'm mostly responsible of making enabling the product designers team to do a good job and to design a good product that we can then sell to our Moovil clients, which mainly are cities and public transit agencies all over the world.
Very cool. So going back 6 years, what made you start Familonet? What was the idea behind it? Because I think it's a product that makes sense to all of us, but it's nice that someone actually went there and did it. Mm-hmm. So what was the first thought behind it? Why did you and two of your mates started a company together?
Mm-hmm. Well, there were basically two factors leading to the entire Familonet story and the foundation of Familonet. First of all, I used to be a student back then, and I'm originally from the Rhineland, so from near Cologne. Mm-hmm. And this was just my personal experience, my personal story. Every time when I drove home, meeting my family, visiting my family, and going back to Hamburg, my mother or my grandmother always would say, like, okay, call me once you're back home. And as you probably know, of course you will forget that. Yeah, and then I came up with the thinking, okay, there must be any kind of a digital way of transferring this kind of information to my family, that I reached home safely. And on the other hand, I was working in a startup back then called Adventure. They are acquired by Ernst & Young, and we were building on any kind of mobile and digital products. And I kind of came in touch with Life360, which is an American-based location sharing, family location sharing application, and saw that they were quite successful over there. So I came up with the idea, okay, let's try something like that over here in Europe, but with some adjustments when it comes to the product and the privacy of the users and the, yep. And the features in the product. And yeah, then we founded the company, worked on the first concept for the product, which was then a real good fit for the German and European market compared yep. to the players that were already out there in America.
Very, very cool. So I read that when you started the company in 2012, you were supported by a Japanese VC or a business angel. Mm-hmm. How did that work? Because usually when you talk to startup, this is the main problem. It's yeah. like, we have a great idea, but we don't have the capital, which is most of the times an excuse, I think.
Yeah, right. I mean, we were quite lucky back then, because normally it does not work the way that you don't have any kind of prototype or something. That you only have a PowerPoint presentation and yeah. will raise the first venture capital, but in our case this went out well and we were quite lucky. So how come my co-founder met this Japanese business angel during his internship or something in Hong Kong, and then one thing led to the other. We pitched him the concept, as said, based on PowerPoint slides, and. Yeah, we somehow convinced him,
yeah.
and then we raised the first quite small amount of money that made us being able to pay our first employee.
Awesome, actually, good start.
Yeah, true. So we didn't earn anything. We couldn't pay any salary or something to ourselves, of course. But we were at least able to pay our first employee, an iOS developer.
At least that. Yeah. So back to you as person, if you connect the dots, growth and yourself, how mm-hmm. would you describe that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, over the last 5 to 6 years, looking at the entire story of founding a company right from being a student, having first employees, also letting go employees, having good times, having hard times, experiencing yeah. the roller coaster of being a founder and of founding a company. Yeah, there's a lot of growth, personal growth in there, which you would actually never expect before experiencing something like that. And yeah, I would say it's especially when it comes to social interaction with other people, with team members, with employees, with clients, with customers, with users, with investors, with other big and small companies that we work with. That's, of course, a lot to learn and yeah. a lot of huge experiences and personal growth that you have there.
Yeah. Since you mentioned it already, like personal growth and having hard times,
mm-hmm.
could you maybe share with us the hardest time you had and how you what you learned from that situation and how you tackled that?
Mm. Yeah, there's different kinds of hard times. There's very, very personal hard times. For example, when you're in a situation for the first time that you need to fire an employee. This, of course, is a very hard situation that you would never experience before. This is emotionally quite hard and quite tough. But on the other hand, there are more business-wise or business-related hard times when it, for example, comes to a point when a funding round blows up one day before the notary public appointment, or some kind of business case or something didn't go well, or a team member or yourself made a huge mistake which cost the company a lot of money. So there's really that roller coaster nearly yeah. on a daily basis. But on the other hand, there are also very, very nice times each and every day, and you also get back a lot from your team members, yeah. from your clients, from your customers, etc.
How did you handle those situations? Was it your co-founders who helped you? Mm-hmm. Or what was it? Or how did you tackle those mm-hmm. situations?
So my co-founders are very huge factor in terms of mutual support and helping in such situations. And I would also say this is very important that you do have such a relationship with your co-founders, that you can speak about everything.
Definitely.
So in our case, it's really that we are not just like my two co-founders, Hauke and David and myself, we're not only business partners, we are also very, very good friends, and we can speak about anything, no matter if it's personal or business or whatever. We do sleep in the same bed, in the shared bed, on business trips, etc. We have so many and rich joint experiences that we gained over the last 6 years. So this is really a very important thing. Yeah, the co-founders.
Yeah, I think, Serhat, as you have founded your own company, I think you feel the same way, that it's, of course, the product needs to be, you need to believe in the product, but in the end, it's about the members, it's the founders, it's the people who make it happen.
Definitely, exactly. Yeah. So I believe actually myself that the team is one of the biggest parts for success of a startup.
True. Yeah, it is. Yeah. And yeah, right. It's not only the co-founders, of course, it's also the team. Yeah,
absolutely.
So it is highly important that the team is on your side, that you have the team with you, that everybody understands the purpose of the entire thing, that everybody identifies with the company, with the spirit, with the vision, with the mission of the company. And yeah, if that is not the case, or if there is a particular person in the team who might blow up the entire thing, then this is really a reason for letting people go.
Makes sense.
Yeah, because otherwise the entire venture won't work out well.
Yeah, but besides all those struggles, you managed to get up to 1 million users back in 2015. Mm-hmm. And how many employees did you have back then, and how did you make that happen? Because you grew around 500,000 users in that 1 year,
mm-hmm.
and you reached published in more than 10 countries.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that was in 2015, right?
Yeah.
I think right now we are at around 2 to 2.5 million users.
Wow.
But yeah, back then the team must have been around 10 people, mainly developers.
Yeah.
So us three founders plus 5 developers, and then marketing team member, and probably 2015 it was a QA, quality assurance engineer or something,
mm-hmm.
or working student or something that
yeah.
we would also have in the team back then.
Very cool.
How did you manage the coordination between the marketing department and the development department, so that actually the marketing could market the product itself, but the development also team could also like improve what the users want?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is of course the big the big challenge and the big task of the product department, because the product department usually is the connection between the market, the users, and on the other hand the technical development.
Yeah. Yeah.
So basically, what the product department in best case does is to translate the market needs and the users' needs and the users' demands into technical features and vice versa. Yeah, and this was mainly my job. And yeah, also of course very crucial is that you as a product guy you work on both sides. So you work together with the tech team, plus you work together with the marketing team, reaching out to the users, reaching out to our families and groups of users, and do user research, approach users, and then giving the right tasks and user stories, for example, back into the technical development team.
Sounds a bit like a translator.
Yeah, it's a translator, yeah. Between users and techies.
So, like Sebastian mentioned, the hockey stick development, how did you actually get your first users on board?
the first users right before the hockey stick.
Exactly. In the beginning, you didn't have even users.
Mm-hmm.
So somehow you had to manage that hockey stick, right? Like getting your first users and somehow exploding it.
Yeah. Probably the first users were you and your founding team.
True. Yeah, also here, like getting our first users, also here we were quite lucky. Because right on that day we officially launched our product, the first version of the FamilioNet application. Right on that day we were covered by RTL and NTV and Bild-Zeitung, which are three of the biggest media TV stations and newspapers, also online in Germany. And this really, really took off on the first day, and our servers couldn't stand that. So I think after a few hours, everything was down.
How long did it take to get it back and running again?
Yeah, also just a few hours.
Yeah.
And then we had our first 10 to 20,000 users right on the first day after a few hours. As said, we were quite lucky with that, but on the other hand, we of course had our stake in that because we prepared everything in advance. We connected with the media people, with the journalist, with the TV and newspaper people, and provided them with a good story that they could publish on their channels. So this was of course our plan that this would happen. Yeah, and it worked out well. And this is how we gained our first users. As said, a few thousand users. And with that amount of users, we were then able to, over the next half a year to a year, we were able to improve the product further. So over the first few months, our main goal was not yet to reach as many users as possible. It was more to improve all of our KPIs in terms of engagement of a user, the retention rate, the conversion funnels, the activation and reactivation of a user, plus the activity of a user. And after a few months, we came to a point where we saw, okay, our numbers have improved, our KPIs and usage tracking numbers are at a very good level now. And this was then the point when we switched our main KPI from retention and engagement to the number of users, the number of active users.
Yeah, awesome. How did you approach the TV stations and newspapers? Because 20,000 users on the first day is the dream for every founder.
Mm-hmm. Was it a coincidence or did you actually approach them yourself?
Yeah, we approached them from ourselves. And I would also say this was highly crucial because if we would just have booked an PR agency or something, they would never have would never been able to reach the same result. I'm sure about that. And for the journalists and the media people, it was just cool that the founders themselves called them or wrote them or texted them or whatever and tried to approach them personally. I think we even met some of them in person for a coffee or something, and this was then very cool for the media people as well. And I'm sure if we would have given this task to an external agency, that wouldn't have worked out.
How many journalists did you need to approach actually? Was it many or just the three?
I think we approached a couple of them, but of course we also focused on the most important media for us. I mean, RTL and Bild-Zeitung are probably the more or less the biggest popular mass media things, and of course we then tried to approach them because they are our vehicle to reach users, to reach the masses of our users, families, parents with kids, etc. If you want to go and if you want to close another founding round or something, then you would rather go for approaching business or tech or startup media, such as TechCrunch or T3N or something like that. But in this case, we wanted to gain users, so the mass popular media was right for us at this point.
How did you contact them? Did you mail them or call them? Or
I think, yeah, we both, everything. We texted them on Twitter. We called them. We wrote them an email. We tried to get introductions from other people that we knew were working in the media already. Yeah, and then somehow it worked out that we gained our first contacts over there, and we just pitched them our story and the story of our product, and also very important, provided them kind of a story that they can tell to their users.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, this is, or to their consumers, to their readers, to their
audience.
To the audience, yeah.
So you basically created a story for them to tell. What you explained in the beginning is it's like the family, everyone knows that problem.
Right.
And that's perfect.
Right. So journalists or media people are always looking for a good next story they can cover or they can tell to their audience. And if you come there and present them a more or less ready to go story.
Yep. I highly appreciate it.
And they're happy about that.
Yeah, I think most founders underestimate the power of PR and of media itself, and also like how they should approach. They forget the story usually, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, also, I mean, it depends on the product. Luckily, in terms of storytelling, our product fits quite well. But there are, of course, other products which don't make it that easy to tell a nice story about that.
Besides PR, did you find any other growth hacking, let's just say growth hacking tactic in your entrepreneurial path, which actually helped you to market FamiloMed and even manage the hockey stick development?
So what we found out over time was that our most valuable users, so the users with a high retention rate, with a good engagement rate, with a high activation rate and good conversion funnels, they came from referrals of other users.
Mm-hmm.
And so we started to think about, okay, how can we even accelerate the referrals from already existing users to new users, to their family, friends and fools. that they would recommend FamiloNet to. And then there are various channels that you can try to accelerate referrals. You can give out free things to your existing users, as you might know it from Dropbox, for example. You get storage for free.
Yeah.
Or you can make it very easy for other users to refer other users. For example, we then displayed the address book and the phone book of every user in the app, so that it was just one tap away to invite other users out of their address book. Then, of course, you always need to think about, okay, what's a benefit for the user?
Yeah.
What can I do for the user that they refer to my product? For example, there was this very smart campaign by MyTaxi. MyTaxi gave out free taxi rides. You were able to use a taxi for free. And this, of course, is a highly smart marketing thing or referral thing, because it's a win-win-win situation.
Yeah.
MyTaxi wins because new masses of users are running into the app stores and downloading the MyTaxi app to get a free taxi ride or to get multiple free taxi rides. On the other hand, the second target group of MyTaxi is also happy, the drivers.
Because they get paid anyways.
They get paid anyways, yes. And they are currently, or they are suddenly facing a high demand of taxi rides. And then, of course, in the end, MyTaxi also benefits out of that because, there's a lot of new users on both of their user sides, on the B2C client side, riders, and on the driver B2B side. And this is something which every product needs to find their sweet spot. What can I do with my product to get people on board or get people to refer to my product?
So you would say the referral program was the most effective growth strategy for you?
This was one strategy to gain very valuable users.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
but there were other strategies as well. For example, we then started also to localize, to translate our application into many, many other languages.
Yeah,
I think right now it's available in 21 languages, wow. including Indonesian and Danish and I don't know what else. and of course, the big languages, English, German, Italian, French, Russian, Spanish, of course, yeah. Even Chinese.
It's so massive.
Yeah. And by that, we also were facing a lot of new users from all over the world, because suddenly people see a version of the application or find a version of the application in their own language. Also, the App Store descriptions, App Store slides, App Store marketing stuff, etc., is translated into Indonesian, for example. This also builds up trust for users over there in other countries. And this was also one very effective and cost-efficient strategy for us to gain new users from all over the world.
Yeah. How did you decide which countries do you want to go in first? I mean, English, of course, makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But when did you decide to go to... FamilioNet is actually really big in Brazil as well as mm-hmm. Turkey and other countries. How did you decide on where to go next?
Yeah, our first two countries we tried out for localization were Brazil and Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
And we came up with kind of an analysis about certain factors, such as how big is the country, what's the population, what's the smartphone distribution over there, how important is family in social life. Also, we wanted to try out two different kind of cultures. So the Turkish culture is way different from the Brazilian culture, but it's still two very big countries, and still in both countries the family is a very almost holy thing.
Yeah.
And then we just tried it out because most of the factors fitted very well for Turkey and Brazil, and we translated the app into Turkish and into Portuguese, and these were just the first two countries we tried, and we saw that it works quite good. And we also started to do some advertising then within those two countries, and that's how we came up cool. with them.
How did your ads, Facebook ads, especially compared to Germany, perform in Turkey and Brazil?
Mm-hmm.
So what did you see as differences? Because I believe cultural differences are a big thing there.
So it was quite funny to see that, or to learn that Portuguese and Turkish people are sharing ads massively more than Germans do. So if you release a Facebook ad, for example, over here, basically nothing happens. There's maybe one or two likes underneath the advertising, and maybe one comment, a critical one. and in Brazil and Turkey, people were sharing the ad like hell, resharing it. They were commenting and linking family and friends underneath the ad, and it was really, it went viral, kind of. And this was really funny to see what differences in social media usage and interaction with advertised social media advertising obviously are. So that was really, really funny to see.
So actually, every euro you spend there was actually much more worth when you spend it here, right?
True. In terms of new users, yes. On the other hand, then you also, of course, want to have valuable users with good retention rates, good engagement, etc. Users that come back, that refer to your product to others, and also users, of course, that pay for the premium services of the product. And when it comes to that, we found out that an average Brazilian or also Turkish user are not that valuable as an average, for example, US American or German user with the same kind of engagement and retention rate.
In the first weeks or first months of FamilioNet, you asked a lot of users for feedback and mm-hmm. how to improve. Mm-hmm. How did you do that with the Brazilian and the Turkish market?
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't think you speak Portuguese or Turkish.
No. what we did in Germany was really that the three of us, the three founders, we had the task each and every week to call 10 of our users.
That's nice.
and that was sometimes, yeah, a bit hard to achieve, but it was a really, really good learning for us. And on the other hand, this is, of course, something we could not do in Turkey and Brazil. There we more relied on quantitative methodologies to gain user feedback, such as a star rating in the app, feedback via an in-app form or via email or via the app stores, of course. App store rating is highly important here. Also, maybe doing a survey or something with our users over there. There we could not be that proactive, but still we gained a lot of feedback from our users from over there. Also, something we saw that Brazilian people are way more willing to rate an application on the App Store and to put their feedback on there. That's the way how we gain feedback from there.
Very cool. So to summarize, you basically had a great idea which came from your personal experience.
Mm-hmm.
You had the perfect preparation when you launched. You had 20,000 users on your first day.
Mm-hmm.
You would say that the team and the employees are the most crucial part about making mm-hmm. it successful.
Mm-hmm.
And you found markets, Brazil, Turkey, for example, which are perfectly suitable for your product.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, it sounds like you really planned every step, right? And that is what you would give as a tip for someone who wants to achieve the same thing, or what would be the number one advice that you could give?
Yeah, planning is valuable, but also things that you cannot really plan suddenly appear. And then it's highly crucial that you recognize this window of opportunity and just jump in. and the first part here, of course, is to recognize the window of opportunity, because sometimes there are windows of opportunities, but you just don't see them. So first of all, see them. And next, really be confident enough to jump in and to try out. And then it's the... Again, the agile way of doing stuff. Just try it out, see if it works. If it works, fine, go on and improve. If it doesn't work, go on and try the next thing.
Awesome.
Also one other advice I would give to every founder is to not hold back with stuff and ideas. Just go out immediately. Talk with each and everybody about your idea, even talk with people who are not into that kind of products at all. Talk to your grandmother, talk to your friends, talk to anybody about your idea. You will get questions and feedback from everybody on your idea, and this is the best way to improve it. No one will steal your idea. In the end, it's all about the execution.
Yeah, that's what many Germans think. I have the feeling it's like, don't share your idea.
No, share it.
Actually, I think it was one of the best closing remarks. Just make things happen.
Yeah.
Don't underestimate PR, and then always try to be user-centric and try to make your users refer your product or
mm-hmm.
your service. So I would just say thank you to you for your time and for sharing all this. And to all of you who are listening today, stay tuned for the next episode.
Thank you, Michel. And tune in 2 weeks, guys.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.